Welcome once again to another episode of There's Just Something About Kansas City. And there's just something about this guy, Terrence O'Malley, who's sitting across from me because he is the first guy that we've had back for a second sit-down conversation about all things mafia in Kansas City. How are you, Terrence?
I'm very fine. Thank
good,
you. I'm
good.
Honored.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, we're honored to have you. The story is fascinating. The last time we did this, we started to talk about the history of the mafia in Kansas City, whatever. And then we went down the rabbit hole of Nellie Dawn and ended up doing the whole episode on Nellie Dawn.
Yeah.
We have probably three more episodes we can do. This will be Black Hand Straw Man. We still have Tom and Harry, which is Tom Pendergast and Harry Truman, and of course the Union Station Massacre. But we'll try to keep our focus here on the mafia, which is a big enough subject anyway. But congratulations on the Nellie Dawn musical, which you wrote, and you just received commendation from both the state of Kansas and the state of Missouri, didn't you, for that film?
Very nice for them to honor the film. And, you know, the reception of the film has been very good. It's now, we're approaching our seventh month in cinemas here in Kansas City. And,
that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, normally a film will run, you know, 3 to 5 weeks at most, but people keep coming to see the film and enjoying the music and enjoying the story and the history and everything. So, no, couldn't be happier with it, really, frankly.
Yeah, right. And it was Nellie Dawn, a musical, which you go, okay, here's this woman. She had an affair with James A. Reed. She got kidnapped by the mafia. They chased the two mafia guys down to South Africa, brought them back home. And you did a musical on this?
Yeah, I know. You know, I have a friend of mine who's a very musical person, and she said, I had to come see this because I just did not understand how you were going to musicalize this. But it really, frankly, wasn't that hard. At least I thought that the story lent itself to the narrative qualities of a musical.
Yeah,
so
that's funny.
Yeah. It's been fun. And,
yeah.
You know, and it's a fun movie, and it's a little campy, but you know, the performances are excellent, and the voices are really Broadway quality.
Yeah.
And so, you know, got great, you know, people in the film. John Trizzola was the cinematographer, and he was great, and Linda Flake was our costumer, and she was great, and just everybody was great. 105 people worked on that film.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's a great deal. Yeah, it was fun. We saw it at Union Station, down on the big screen at Union Station, so it was a lot of fun. So, okay, let's get back to Terrence O'Malley, the man, of course, top 100 most influential people in Kansas City, and you are just a fascinating character. Let me ask you a question. A lot of this is mafia-oriented. What sparked your interest in doing something like this, the mafia and the history of the mafia in Kansas City?
Well, really what got me going was when I was researching Nellie Dawn, and I didn't realize that the mafia had rescued Nellie Dawn, Johnny Lazzia, head of the, you know, he was a mob leader back in the 20s and 30s. And I didn't know until I was doing my research, you know, years later about the Nellie Dawn story that I realized that in that particular story, the gangsters are the good guys because, they rescued Nell. But then I got to thinking, you know, and this was true, you know, back in 02, 03, nobody had ever given any type of serious treatment to the mafia in Kansas City. So I began my research really during Nellie Dawn research, but then after I released Nellie Dawn, I really went after the mafia here in Kansas City. And it was, fortuitous because a couple of people were writing books at that time. Frank Haid was going to come out with The Mafia and The Machine. And
that'd be about Tom Pendergast.
It was just a different take. And then Bill Owsley, he was an FBI agent who was on the Kansas City Organized Crime Strike Force. And so he had been writing a book for years. And so he actually gave me that book to help him edit. And he self-published a book called Open City, which is really good about the early era of organized crime. And then he did a book subsequent to that called Mobsters in Our Midst. And so it was great because these guys were like, they were kind of rushing to publication because they knew that I was coming out with the movie. Well, I decided, they'll be great interview subjects. So I was able to include them in the film Black Hand Straw Man. So they add a lot to the film.
Yeah, there is a lot in that film. The thing about it, a lot of people, even my age or whatever, they'll think that the age of the mafia was the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s,
yeah.
You know, maybe late 40s, mm-hmm. 50s, you know, Bonnie and Clyde and, you know, Dillinger and Babyface Nelson and, you know, Pretty Boy Floyd, all these guys. But it really started way before that. It started back around the turn of the century, maybe?
Really, I mean, in Kansas City.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, in Kansas City.
Absolutely. I mean, 66% of the Italian population that wound up in Kansas City were Sicilians. And so they had lived under the kind of mafia system in Sicily, which was a number of powerful families that governed regions of Sicily and Calabria. And, you know, essentially it was a terroristic system.
Right.
You paid homage to, you know, the leaders of the family, you know, certain things, you know, you weren't allowed to conduct certain businesses without, you know, paying a cut or a lug.
Wet my beak.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that, you know, system when the Italians migrated over to America, in many of the cities, they basically imported that system of terror, where they essentially were extorting money from their fellow countrymen, and that went on. That was the Black Hand era, when they would send Black Hand letters. It comes from, you know, they would do an imprint of a Black Hand on a piece of paper. And it really started in New York City. I think the first, you know, Black Hand letter really was in New York City. Mm-hmm. And it was just a term that the media picked up.
It's perfect.
Yeah, it was something that people could grasp onto. Yeah. But it really was a very sad era, especially in Kansas City. I mean, you can look from about 1905 to 1915. There were maybe 40 or 50 Black Hand murders here in Kansas City. Maybe old grudges that were coming mm-hmm. over from the old country, but you had little cells of criminals that would get together and decide who the next target was going to be, and then issue a Black Hand demand. And sometimes they would follow through on the violence, and sometimes they wouldn't. But you didn't know, and so you were scared out of your wits for fear that, you know, your family was going to be terrorized.
And didn't a lot of people leave Sicily because they're trying to get away from this? And all of a sudden they come to the United States, they immigrate here, and then all of a sudden they're right back in the pot.
Yeah, and it's even more – it's even scarier because they don't speak the language. And they don't trust the police authorities. You know, it's a totally different system. They didn't trust the police authorities in Sicily, so why would they trust them when they come over to the United States? And notwithstanding, the police, Kansas City Police Department, did reach out to the Italian community and tried to help them. But the whole concept of omerta, which was kind of a conspiracy of silence, prevailed. And so while, you know, there were some times when the business community of the Italians got sick of the Black Hand and went down and they talked to the police about it. But boy, when it finally came time to identify them and prosecute them, they backed away. Because, you know,
they, all of a sudden they wouldn't be a witness anymore.
Right. And, you know, typically what they would do is they wouldn't target, say, the head of the family. They might target a member of the family because they don't want to kill the golden goose, right? You don't kill the person who can make the payments. But you do, you know, perpetrate some type of crime against their family or friends or neighbors, whomever it is they're close to. And that's how you sent your message.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And to me, the other interesting thing for me is, okay, you have New York and Chicago, and we know they're big cities, and they had their organized crime, whatever. How did Kansas City become this? And I know you said a lot of the people came from Sicily or whatever, and that just brought it in here, but Kansas City became a big player as far as the mafia is concerned in the entire country. Right?
Yeah, it really did. I mean, I always tell people that Kansas City played a greater, more prominent role than its size would have led you to believe. And like, you know, cities like Dallas and Denver and Salt Lake and these places, they didn't have these mafia problems the way right. Kansas City did. And the reason why is, first of all, you did have a large, large influx of Italians. I mean, by 1930, there were something like 10,000 Italians, you know, basically crammed into Little Italy on the north side of Kansas City, which would basically be described as, say, Grand Avenue on the west, Independence Avenue on the south side, maybe Lydia or Tracy on the east side, and then the river, you know, and then there's just tons of Italians packed in there. And so highly congested and highly vulnerable to the, you know, the criminal activity. Well, anyway, so Kansas City became, I think, what solidified Kansas City's ongoing influence in the national syndicate was the Pendergast machine, because the Pendergast machine allowed our Italian gangsters to thrive. So that even when the Pendergast political machine went down in 1939, when Tom Pendergast was sent to prison for tax evasion, that was the end of the political machine, but that wasn't the end of the mafia here right. in Kansas City. And by that time, the national syndicate had been formed. And Kansas City was always under the dominance of Chicago, more so than New York. I think St. Louis was controlled more by New York, but Kansas City was kind of more under the Capone organization. And really, St. Louis did not have a, you know, they had some gangs, you know, back there, they didn't, it didn't flourish the way it did in Kansas City under the Pendergast machine, which, of course, you know, their MO was to allow all these sin businesses to operate here in Kansas, you know, gambling places, you know, liquor distribution.
During Prohibition.
Yeah, prostitution, obviously. Right. And a lot of narcotics ran through Kansas City during the 20s and 30s, heroin especially. And so it just got stronger here. But then when Pendergast went down, well, you know, the criminal elements, they didn't go away. I mean, they still had their, you know, wares to ply. And right. so it really hung on during the 1940s after, you know, Pendergast went to prison.
Yeah, and the other thing for me is, why did – what was the attraction for all the people from Sicily to come to Kansas City? Was there an attraction here? Because they could have gone to Chicago or to New York,
sure,
or to, you know, Miami or wherever. Why can't, what was the attraction that brought everybody here?
Well, so, you know, a lot of Italians decided, because they heard that there were jobs out west, and so. And these people were laborers.
Yes.
They were working class people. And so instead of getting off the boat in New York or Boston, say, they took the boat around to New Orleans. That's why you have a very large Italian section in, you know, in New Orleans. And then they would take the riverboats up to St. Louis. Of course, you have the hill section in St. Louis. But they would stay on the boats and come on over to Kansas City, because Kansas City was just booming economically. There was just so much industry going on here, because really Kansas City was the largest city between here and San Francisco and Los Angeles until well after World War II. And so it was really all about the employment opportunities here.
Yeah, wow, that's that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
But for them to just stay on the boat and keep going, you know, they get to St. Louis, go, no, I think we're going to keep going because of the fact that there are jobs.
Yeah,
in Kansas City.
The Italian mafioso culture is, you know, fascinating to you know, many, many people, but to the Italians themselves, especially the ones that were trying to escape it or wanted nothing to do with it, which was the vast majority of them.
Right.
I mean, they were not – the vast majority of Italians are not criminals by nature. And I think it has a lot to do with the language. They were just segregated.
Sure.
So it took them a generation or two to assimilate. And so in the interim, they're clustered with each other, and they're poor – dirt poor, trying to make their way out of poverty, and crime was easily accessible. And then, of course, you know, a lot of the guys that were criminals over in Sicily, they were criminals
sure.
when they came over here.
Sure.
I think that, you know, the romance of the mafia. I tell people all the time, you know, when they're like, you know, doing tours and stuff like that, you got to be a little careful about dancing on these people's graves, right? Because I know many families here in Kansas City that were absolutely devastated by what happened. Their families were the victims of organized crime.
Right.
Now, I will say this, that Kansas City's criminal mafioso were very good, generally speaking, about keeping it relative to business. You know, in the later years, really, you don't hear a lot about innocent people being killed. I mean, there are a few instances, but generally speaking, they were very good at what they did and very professional about it, and they kept it to within their only own business interests.
Right.
So that was another thing I think about it, is that the mafia was just part of the culture of Kansas City. I mean, I remember being a little kid, I think I may have mentioned this, that, you know, we were driving by an Italian restaurant one time, and my dad, who was a physician, and then, you know, Irish physician, would have nothing to do with the mafia, would know nothing about all, but he said, "That's a mafia hangout. That's where the mafia is." And for my father to know such a thing, you know, just kind of as evidence that, you know, the culture of the mafia in Kansas City had permeated our society.
Right.
I mean, it's very clear, like at St. Teresa's Academy, there was a grotto there that was donated by the Lococo family. Well, Gaetano Lococo was a notorious hitman here in Kansas City. And to think that, you know, here, you know, he set up this.
They went to church every Sunday.
Yeah,
come on.
They did. They did. But I mean, you go through the litany of the families here. The DiGiovannis are a prominent family here in Kansas City. And, you know, Joe DiGiovanni and his brother, Sugarhouse Pete DiGiovanni, were serious perpetrators of Black Hand extortion, and then later on, you know, just part of the syndicate. They would have been what they call the Mustache Petes.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they called them greasers, various names for them. But they were kind of the elder statesmen of the mafia here in Kansas City. Another guy was James Balestrieri. And they're all related. They've got cousins,
sure,
you know, all over the place. And, you know, they're all related. I will say this. I think that most of the mafioso who were successful, they did not want their children to go into this line of work. And that's why you find so many Italians who are in, you know, professional positions. They're engineers, architects,
right,
you know, physicians, attorneys, what have you. And so they have elevated themselves. They didn't continue to perpetrate maybe what their parents or grandparents did. But nevertheless, they do suffer from the association that people have with Italians and organized crime, especially in Kansas City.
Yeah, right. And so this era in Kansas City went from like the 1900s, okay, mm-hmm, to about 1980?
I draw it at 86.
And 1986.
Well, the reason, I mean, there was a little bit of activity that continued after that, but in 1986, they had the second straw man prosecution. And straw man was the FBI code name that they gave to the investigation of the casinos in Las Vegas. And so that investigation was anchored here in Kansas City. And so they had a first round of prosecutions, I think, in 82, maybe 83. And then they had the second round in 86. And I really think that put the stake through the heart of the mafia as we would have known it.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And so that is about the book, Black Hand, Straw Man.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the straw man comes from.
Yep.
And we know where Black Hand originated with the hand on the letters.
Mm-hmm.
Straw Man and the idea behind Straw Man, what was the significance of that name, Straw Man?
Well, because it had to do What a complicated situation it was, and how the FBI discovered it is just fascinating. But they overheard Tuffy DeLuna and Cork Savelle and maybe some others talking about it in code, talking about activities going on out in Las Vegas, and because they were investigating some local murders here. You know, the River Key wars going on, mm-hmm, during the 1970s, and they had the war with the Spiro brothers happening in the 1970s. So So they overheard these guys talking about activity in Las Vegas. And what they came to find out, what they ultimately discovered, was that there were, especially at a couple of the more prominent, I think the Tropicana was one of them, there was just a figurehead who was ostensibly running the hotel. But behind the strings, you had the mafiosa from Kansas City, Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Chicago that were, you know, skimming off of the casino. So they would have their own people in the counting rooms, and that's where they could, you know, skim the cash and put it into what they called sandwiches that would come through Kansas City every Friday and carried on an airplane by a courier. And then it would go to Nick Civella, who then would divide it up again, you know, with his crew here in Kansas City. But then also it would go get shipped up to, you know, Chicago and to Cleveland and Milwaukee. So that was the significance of straw man, is that you had a figurehead in these hotels. And basically,
here, so he was the straw man.
Yeah. And here's what happened. A lot of those hotels in the 1970s, casinos were kind of getting long in the tooth. They were kind of dragging. People weren't going out to Vegas as much as they do right now. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't as much on entertainment. It was more on gambling, and it was kind of perceived as a corrupt city, you know. I mean, obviously.
Prostitution.
Rampant prostitution. And so these hotels needed money. They needed an injection of cash. They needed to refurbish. They needed to do a lot of things. And so it's a little complicated, but Nick Civella had control over a guy named Roy Williams, who was high up in the echelon of the Teamsters. And so they got the Teamsters to loan money to these hotels. And then the idea is, well, you know, we're gonna loan money to these hotels. We're going to get them refurbished and rebuilt. We're going to have them operating at a high level. And then we're going to skim from them, and we're going to drive them into bankruptcy. And then at that point, the Teamsters will be the main creditor, and they can take over running the hotels. So it was just the kind of long plan, strategic plan for the mafia to actually take over the management of the hotels more directly through their influence over the Teamsters. Now, how do they get influence on the Teamsters? Well, in Kansas City, I can tell you exactly how they did it, which is that they basically, Nick Civella and others, but primarily Nick became the guy in the 1950s. And the reason why he became head of the mafia is he was a driver for Anthony Gizzo. And Anthony Gizzo took over after Bonaggio and Gargatta were murdered on Truman Boulevard in Democratic headquarters underneath this huge picture of Harry Truman and the governor. But he had been a driver for Anthony Gizzo, and he was kind of Gizzo's street boss, if you will. And so he was a member of the Teamsters, or at least he insinuated his membership in the Teamsters. And basically, he and some other fellows basically took Roy Williams one night, and this was Nick Civella's MO. He would take him into like an empty space, empty apartment, empty warehouse, wherever, and shine a bright light on them so they could barely see, and then talk to them and say, okay, here's now what you will do. And, you know, he threatened Roy Williams very explicitly. He said, if you do not do these things, we will kill the members of your family, and then we will kill you. But we will kill them first so that you know, that we wiped out your family. So Roy Williams was scared to death of Nick Civella from there on. They got along civilly, you know, and they meant, but at the end of the day, it was under duress and threat that Roy Williams did what he did. And I believe, you can correct me on this, but I believe Roy Williams was under indictment when he got nominated to be president of the Teamsters. I mean, that's how powerful the mob was in terms of elevating these guys, because they were all under, you know, suspicion and FBI surveillance and investigation, and yet here they were, continued to just rise to the top of this, you know, major organization. And, of course, they used money from the pension plans of the Teamsters to do the, to loan the money to the hotels, which then they were going to drive into bankruptcy and take over. So so that's what the straw man part was all about, is just putting these figureheads into these hotels.
Yeah. And so, yeah, in the I mean, this is so much The Godfather.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so many of these elements that are in those Godfather movies.
Well, and I think it's interesting that in the original Godfather, the first Godfather 1, you know, they have a meeting of the five families.
Yes.
And then other, other, you know, mafia family representatives. And, of course, they recognize Kansas City. And that's because Kansas City was an integral part to the overall syndicate system.
Right.
It contributed to it
quite
a bit.
Yeah, it was amazing because you talk about this and it's, you know, you can also remember, ah, this isn't personal, it's business. We're going to kill somebody. Sorry, you know.
So it's so
interesting. And I guess then the prohibition ends up during part of this period of time in the 20s. And you get a prohibition before for the Volstead Act. And the deal is I guess I read it somewhere where during prohibition, during the whole era of the prohibition, where it was illegal to have booze, whatever, that there was not one arrest made in Kansas City because of prohibition, because somebody broke the law.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, is it
a great legend that we're just going to
keep
on?
Well, I can tell you this. Kansas City certainly was among the wettest cities in the United States during prohibition. But for sure, along Independence Avenue was a notorious nightclub, you know, known as Dante's Inferno.
Uh-huh.
And it was right down the street from the, I think it's the Nolo Lusco flower shop. And above those two businesses was a warren of rooms where vagabonds and itinerant Italians and people would come and sleep. And, you know, basically it was a flop house, you know. Well, federal prohibition agents, Kansas City police, I don't believe ever arrested anybody for prohibition. I'm talking about Kansas City police.
Right.
But you did have federal officers around. And so they did a raid one night into this warren of rooms that was above the Lusco Noto Flower Shop, Dante's Inferno. And they had a bunch of guys, you know, they went into the rooms with guns and had a bunch of guys there. And one of the guys just started a shootout and shot a federal agent right there and killed him. And then he ran downstairs and he shot this poor black man that was just walking along the street who got in his way and shot and killed him. Just get out of my way. Well, that was Pretty Boy Floyd who shot that agent. So, you know, they were attempting, I know for sure, they were attempting to make arrests during this era. And I do believe some guys got arrested, but, you know, whether or not, you know, prohibition, I don't know, because, you know, they weren't making wine or beer or whatever up there. So that's it.
But they were distributing it.
No. So.
Oh, they weren't.
I mean, I don't know what they were doing up there. All I know is prohibition agents went up there to effect a bust. And presumably for prohibition, yeah. So, you know, violation of the Volstead Act. But I didn't get very far with it because Pretty Boy Floyd just started shooting. And because Pretty Boy Floyd by this time was like, yeah, I'm never going to be taken alive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys, those are the rogue gangsters of the gangster era. I mean, those guys, Dillinger, Bonnie and Clyde, they all knew they were going to get killed. They knew that we're not going to prison.
Right.
Yeah, because all they're going to do is hang us anyway. So, you know, they knew their lives were over. So,
So
it was no big deal for them but to carelessly just kill whoever they needed to get out of the way and escape because they knew they were going to get hanged anyway.
It's amazing to have these people in and out of the Kansas City scene, Pretty Boy Floyds and Dillinger's and Bonnie and Clyde, and all these people that are notorious,
that
we've read about all our lives. Yeah.
No,
but a lot
of them came to Kansas City because it was a wide open town. If you knew somebody, you could lay low. Vern Miller, who was one of the perpetrators of the Union Station Massacre, he lived at, I think it was 6612 Edgevale Road. And he lived there under an alias as a traveling salesman, so it wouldn't look weird.
Well, he was in some ways.
Well, he was. He was a traveling hitman. But he'd go away and rob some banks, and then he'd come back, and people would think, well, he's on the road. He's a salesman, you know. Wow. So, yeah, I mean, it was pretty rife. I mean, there was a lot going on here. You know, the two statues out in front of City Hall back in the day, one was called Cut and the other one was called Lug because, you know, the Pendergast machine basically took a cut off of people's salaries. Mm-hmm. And then they had a lug where they had to contribute to the Democratic politics of the day. And so
there was to keep things flowing under the Pendergast
machine.
Keep the
Pendergast
right?
machine going because Tom Pendergast himself was a gambling addict. And so he constantly needed more and more cash to pay off these bad, you know, bets that he was making. And so, you know, he became, you know, much more associated with the mafia and the Italians in the 20s and 30s. Than he had been previously.
Yeah. So how did he rise? How did Pendergast rise to power?
Well, you know, it's not like, you know, or even Nick Civella, it's not like you wake up one day and beat your chest and declare yourself that I'm the political boss or I'm the mob boss. So all of it has its evolution. But basically, in the 20s, Pendergast had been part of numerous political factions in Kansas City. In the turn of the century, you had the Republicans who aligned themselves with the Ku Klux Klan in the 20s and defeated Harry Truman the first time he was up for re-election. But then you had the goats and the rabbits. The goats were the Pendergast people and the rabbits were the Shannon people, these political factions. But in 1925, there was a plebiscite here in Kansas City where we voted to change our city charter from 32 aldermen to 9 councilmen. Well, and they were all supposed to be nonpartisan. And so what happened was Pendergast managed to get 5 of his people elected to the city council, who then appointed the city manager. We went to a strong manager, which we still have to this day. We have a weak mayor, strong manager that runs the city. And so Pendergast managed to
get— No, you didn't mean the mayor's weak. It's just that he doesn't have the power a mayoral city government has, right? A mayoral is the mayor is the last word.
Right.
In this government here, it is the city council it's the last
word. Well, it's the city council and the city manager.
And the manager.
Right. Basically runs the city.
Yes, exactly.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, I don't mean it as a, you know, pejorative term in terms of, you know, those people in office. But
right.
So Pendergast, as of 1926, he's got control of the city council. He's got control of the city manager's office. He's also gotten Harry Truman elected to be on that. They used to call them judges, but it was a county commission that led out the capital improvement projects.
Mm-hmm.
So he got there was 3 of them. So he got 2 out of 3 elected so he could do whatever he wanted. And Harry Truman, I mean, they were doing good things. I mean, Harry Truman oversaw some $80 million worth of construction here in Kansas City and built roads, 240 miles of roads. So did great works the 8 years that he was in that office. But it was also well known that, you know, it's Democrats who get the jobs.
Yeah. And Tom Pendergast is backing him.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And they had a system where, you know, Pendergast would write, say, in blue ink that would say, hey, don't hire quite yet. Black ink would mean yes. Hire this guy in red ink would mean yeah. Don't hire under any circumstances. So they had that little system going on. And Harry Truman, that's where Harry Truman really engaged and was contributed to the Pendergast machine. Was he hired Democrats?
Right.
Yeah. If you're a Republican, well, too bad, so sad. Wait till you get back in office, then you can hire Republicans.
Change your affiliation.
Yeah, but I mean, it was because there were so many jobs at stake, and you know, it's also the Depression. And so if you wanted
a job, they were very
important.
Yeah,
you had to be politically affiliated. And then in 1928, Johnny Lazzia, on election day, kidnapped 4 Pendergast poll workers, put guns to their heads, and basically threatened Tom Pendergast, said, you know, you either give us home rule over the Italian district, political district, or else we're going to kill these guys. So Pendergast knew at that moment he couldn't go to war against the Italians. Because Pendergast was a political boss. He was not a criminal boss.
Yes, right.
Sure, were there crimes probably being committed, yeah, but not the terroristic version of them that you saw with the mafia. So, you know, so next thing you know, Tom Pendergast and Johnny Lazzia have a very close affiliation and relationship. And that's really when Pendergast just let loose, said, you know, we paid our police force very poorly back in the day. I mean, they had to buy their own billy clubs, their own uniforms, their own blackjacks, their own service revolvers. And they got paid very poorly, something around, I think, $1,300, $1,400 a year. But they had to pay a cut of their salary, and then they had to belong to these Democratic clubs. And so, you know, by the end of the day, they were making, you know, $700, $800, $900 a year. And so the idea was pay them very poorly so that they'll be susceptible to bribes, and so that they'll, you know, from the sin businesses, let the sin businesses pay the cops directly to look the other way and allow, you know, the great, you know, jazz era of Kansas City to flourish.
Wow. That's that's incredible. And Lazzia, and the Irish did join up with the mafia, right? They sort of
Pendergast were Irish. They
right, that's what I was going to say. It's Ireland. Pendergast, and that sort of started that affiliation where the Irish and the Italians are now sort of joining forces, right?
They are, but the Italians, again, I think it has as much to do with the language. I mean, there was great discrimination against the Italians in Kansas City.
Right.
I mean, the same way that the Irish were discriminated against. The benefit that the Irish had was that they spoke the language.
Right.
Yeah. And in my mind, they spoke it better than the English did, you know. So so they had a beautiful lilt to the language. So, you know, they got over that in a generation.
Right.
But the Italians, it was a little harder for them to assimilate. I mean, they're darker colored skin, of them, and they speak this foreign language. They don't understand English that well. They don't write English that well. So a lot of them did not perform well in school. So they're out on the streets.
Now they're prime members to join.
They're prime targets for the elders to say, "Hey, kid, come over here."
Yeah.
And I want you to run this over here. Well, you start paying them, and they're like, "Yeah, man, I'm getting money. I, you know, I'm getting a dollar because I just dropped off some package," which, you know, during Depression eras would be, you know, monumental.
Right.
So that is really their informal. They looked for kids that were from troubled families.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wouldn't go after the best and brightest. You'd look at this kid who's wandering the streets with nothing to do.
It's like the gangs do today.
Today.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. It you know, perpetuates itself. But anyway, so you ask about Pendergast. Well, there's some other things that happen. And of course, we'll talk about this when we do Tom and Harry. But, you know, Pendergast also was very lucky. In 1932, the Democratic candidate for governor, Francis Wilson, fell over dead 1 month before the general election. And so Tom Pendergast just handpicked this guy to run for him. So next thing you know, Pendergast flunky is the governor of Missouri. And then also the governor of Missouri, who was on his way out, a Republican, he vetoed the Republican passed the voting plan, the redistricting plan. So every congressman was running at large so that if you were, say, from Joplin or from Cape Girardeau or something, you were getting voted on by everybody in the state. And so Tom Pendergast was the only guy in the state who could guarantee 100,000 votes, no questions asked. So that gave him...
From non-registered or dead voters or whatever
right. Cemetery commuters.
Whatever. Exactly.
Right.
That's
so,
exactly.
You know, you had that going on. And then when in 1932 at the convention in Chicago, Pendergast struck a deal with the Roosevelt people that all of the New Deal money would flow through Kansas City.
Wow.
So at that point in time, you really, after the New Deal got up and running, the WPA programs and whatever, you know, Tom Pendergast really had control over some 80,000 jobs across the state of Missouri.
Wow.
So that's how you become a political boss. You become very strong like that.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But he was cheating at the polls, too.
Yeah.
In 1936, they had the largest vote fraud prosecution in the United States. 279 people got indicted, and they convicted. 278 got indicted, 259 got convicted.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And I think 80-some of those actually went to prison.
Oh,
yeah, so you've never seen a vote fraud process. I mean, that's what I think that the, you know, election conversation about fraud, you know, is comical.
compared to what happened back in the day.
It was real vote fraud back then. Now it's you know, some elderly person who forgot that they were registered in Arkansas and voted twice. You know, that there's your vote fraud.
So, yeah, right.
Yeah, they were kind of amateur.
Just a little bit different.
Yeah,
somebody's stuffing the ballot box. So one of the most fascinating characters, I think, through this whole thing, and he became the public face of the mafia, was Johnny Lazzia.
Yeah.
So what was his rise through?
Yeah, Lazzia was interesting. He was obviously he was a bright student, but he only got educated through eighth grade. But he was sophisticated. He spoke well. He was a handsome guy, and he actually was clerking at a law firm for some while, and everybody thought that he might have a career in the law. Well, in a sense, he did. He had a career in breaking the law. but he got caught. They were strong-arming a saloon owner, and they got caught, and he got sentenced to prison. And some machinations behind the scenes, I think Jim Aylward was very much responsible for it. They got Lazzia out of prison after like only 7 or 8 months. And he came back and he declared that he was reformed, but actually he was not at all. I mean, you know, once you have that stigma of having a felony, it's
especially
hard.
Especially back in the day.
And I think that's one of the things that people don't appreciate about Prohibition. And frankly, you know, I analogize it to, you know, these states that still have criminalized marijuana, that you're really ruining a lot of people's lives by, you know, stigmatizing them with these felonies that makes it very difficult for them to find employment. And so you had that going on with Prohibition. You know, it'd be like, you know, Uncle Louie would, you know, get his nephews to come help unload a truck on Saturday morning. Well, next thing you know, they're getting busted for bootlegging. And next thing you know, these young kids, these young people have a felony arrest record.
Yeah, right.
And so it hurt them a lot. It set them back quite a bit, which then, you know, does nothing except to, you know, drive them into the society that will accept them as a felony, which
are
the criminal operators, you know. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, Johnny Lazzia, he was instrumental in his role in the Union Station massacre. He's the one who hooked up Vern Miller with Pretty Boy Floyd and Adam Ricchetti, and he also really kind of provided the solution to the Union Station massacre, because Lazzia was assassinated on July 10th, 1934, in front of the Park Apartments right there on Armour Boulevard.
Oh my gosh.
And it was a terrible hit. He lay there on the ground. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning, screaming out in pain. Then they did multiple blood transfusions with him, and he was just screaming bloody murder at St. Joseph Hospital. And then he died about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but he was in absolute utter misery that entire time. And but one of his last words were to say goodbye to his good friend Tom Pendergast. They'd become really close.
Yeah.
And there's correspondence in my book that shows that Jim Pendergast, Tom's nephew, you know, wrote to people and said, God, everything was going along so smoothly and everything was running great. And then Lazzia gets killed. Well, a gang war broke out after Lazzia's murder.
Mm-hmm. And now they're looking for who's the next guy, right?
Well, you have two investigations going on, let's say. I mean, Lazzia's gang knew who did the murder. But it was the police were also trying to figure out, well, who murdered him. But the Lazzia gangs, a gang war broke out in Kansas. So there were shootings, you know, running gun battles in Kansas City. And the one guy got chased out of town. His name was Jimmy Needles LaCapra. He was called Needles because he was a heroin addict. And so they chased this guy all the way down to Wellington, Kansas. And it was interesting because there was a shootout down there, and the guys that were trying to kill LaCapra also got arrested, and they all got taken to the same jailhouse there in Wellington, Kansas. And then so the Kansas City Police Department heard about it, and one of the corrupt police officers rushed down there to try and take possession of him because he was going to kill. He wanted LaCapra. They wanted him killed, and the police department did. For killing Lazzia.
Yeah.
But the feds also heard about it, and they rushed down there, and they asserted their authority. And Jimmy Needles LeCaper basically spilled the beans over everything that went down with the Union Station massacre. And I do believe his account. There's just too much detail in the account. And it's also, a lot of people say, well, you don't know who did the Union Station massacre. I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure we know.
read a book.
Yeah, right, right. Robert Unger did excellent research in his book, which was has that long title, which is The Original Sin of the FBI, Union Station Massacre. So anyway, that was Johnny Lazzie. He was out. 10,000 people went to his funeral. He was a very popular man in Kansas City. He, you know, as Bill Owsley said, he was here, he was there, he was open about it. He was Mr. Organized Crime in Kansas City. The old Black Canders mustache Pete's had pushed him out to the forefront to be the face of the Italian, you know, organized system.
Yeah, he wore it as a badge of honor.
He did. And then several others followed him. Charlie Carollo kind of took over. He was a little softer personality. He was a mathematical genius, but he got – he got sentenced to Leavenworth, and he was running so much contraband out of Leavenworth that they had to move him to Alcatraz. And then when he came back, they deported him, and he snuck back into the country in the 70s. I mean, so his is a really –
guys just don't want to quit.
Yeah, no, they don't. And but that particular family, the highly intelligent and wonderful people, his son became one of the EPA Superfund managers in Chicago, which is no small job.
No,
and he himself, I think, was a math genius as well. Charlie Carollo could keep all the numbers in his head. And then you had a big drug prosecution here in Kansas City in the 1940s where basically they wiped out the heroin trade. But up until that time, it was a flourishing trade. All you have to do is think of Charlie Parker, who was probably hopelessly addicted to mafia heroin by the time he left Kansas City. So the heroin would start in the poppy fields of Afghanistan, go to Marseille, France, and then go to Havana, Cuba, to Tampa, Florida, to Kansas City for distribution in the Midwest because our guys had relationships with the Antonori family in Tampa. And so so they had a big prosecution in 1943, and it's really fascinating because they did actual – it wasn't wiretapping, but it was eavesdropping at the President Hotel right in downtown Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And they heard these two guys talking about it from Tampa. I think one was from Tampa, one was from Kansas City. So they had them dead to rights. And so they convicted, I think, like 13 people in the middle of the war – 1943, they convicted these guys of heroin. So Kansas City really after that was not a major drug distribution hub, right? And, you know, Nick Civella personally was opposed to it. You know, a lot of people say, well, that's because he was just opposed to drugs, you know, and he thought that they were pernicious and, you know, deleterious toward his culture and the Italians. But I think it really had to do with the fact that these drug offenses carried higher prison sentences.
Yeah.
And so you were exposed to a much longer time in prison than you were if you were, like, you know, running a crap game or something like that.
Yeah, and again, we go back to Don Corleone. He was opposed to the drug business,
right? So,
these are all taken from
reality.
All taken from reality. And the French Connection with the poppies and the heroin and the whole thing going through New York City or whatever it was there, you know, Popeye Doyle.
Yeah.
But they're all just sort of tied all the way from the early, you know, late 1800s to the, you know, all the way through 1980s.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing.
It is incredible.
There's been this continuation that really, I don't think any point in time where you didn't have illegal drugs coming into the country from other countries. Yeah.
Wow. That's just incredible.
Now, you know what the difference is? I tell people this all the time because I'm an attorney. But you know what the difference is between a felony and a misdemeanor? It's one day. So what do I mean by that? It means that if the penalty that you are exposed to carries a sentence of 1 year or more, then that's by definition a felony. So a misdemeanor can only be less than 1 year.
Right.
Okay. So people a lot of times don't understand what's the difference between a misdemeanor and a felony. It's one day. So if you can be sentenced up to 2 years, that's a felony. But if the maximum sentence is 6 months, that's a misdemeanor.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't look quite as bad on your record, but still, you have a misdemeanor anyway. It probably depends on what the misdemeanor was.
Yeah.
For all practical purposes,
right.
What you were doing
sure.
with a misdemeanor.
Well, so disorderly conduct is a lot
yeah,
different
right.
from spousal battery
yes,
or something like
exactly.
that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, crazy. Fascinating. As usual, fascinating conversation with you. We will come back to Tom and Harry, Tom Pendergast, Harry Truman, and the influence on that. We will do that another time.
Sure.
We'll get together and just we'll have another session.
Well, we really haven't
talked. You'll be the only three-time guest.
Well, because, the Civella era is where things really,
yes.
I tell people all the time, you would think that when Charlie Benaggio and Charlie Gargatta were killed in 1950, which was a national hit, and Harry Truman was president at the time, that you would have thought that would have been the apex of organized crime in Kansas City. But really, it really wasn't until the 70s when Kansas City's, mafia system was stronger than it ever had been.
Yeah.
Notwithstanding, everybody knew it. They knew who the players were. They knew who the families were. And yet they were still able to ply their trades
sure.
and do everything that they had a hand in. Well, the big thing they had going on in Kansas City for years was the policy record, the numbers record, where they go around and
yeah.
people just choose numbers at
numbers
random.
Numbers and try to win. Yeah, I'm going to win
yeah.
win my thousands today.
That's right. That's right. And, of course, gambling is how Nick Civella ended up going to prison, mm-hmm. Due to the phone call that he made up to the trap on Super Bowl Sunday when the Vikings played the Chiefs in 1970.
And where Len Dawson got sort of – mixed in because he knew them.
Yeah.
And so they tried to relate his name to them. And then all of a sudden it blew up at the Super Bowl. It actually blew up that weekend.
Yeah.
I think it was Friday or something because it wasn't this week-long event that it became. And
yeah.
they get there on Friday and all of a sudden they're talking about Len Dawson.
Yeah.
And organized crime and – is he going to throw the Super Bowl? What's going on?
Yeah, it was much ado about nothing.
Yes, exactly. He was not implicated at all.
No, he was not. Yeah. So, but you had a lot of events, like that happen. And of course, they went to war with the Spiro brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they had the whole River Key thing
yeah.
going on. And Freddie Bonadonna, who owned Poor Freddy's down there. He had a successful bar running. His father was in the mob, but he did not want any part of it. But then after they knocked down 12th Street, where the Marriott is today, mm-hmm. well, that was a whole row of seedy businesses. And so they condemned all of those back in the 70s to build the Marriott. And so those businesses needed a place to relocate, and they chose the River Key.
Mm-hmm.
And then Freddie Bonadonna opposed their efforts, and then there was a lot of interface with the city council because they needed the city council to pass ordinances that would allow them to conduct business. And
right.
so you had a lot of insinuation in the city council. And of course there was, mayhem going on then down in the River Key as a result of all of that,
right.
And several murders and several bombings took place and, it just basically ruined it for people. It's not that it was happening every day, every moment,
no.
but it's like, you just didn't
Once
know.
It happens,
yeah.
we're not going there.
Yeah,
right.
not going there.
That was also the reason, we're going to get off into deep end again. That's also the reason that everybody wanted to develop the River Key, maybe put a stadium down there or put something down there, and nobody would sell.
Yeah.
Nobody would sell the – well, who owns the – why won't they sell or whatever?
Right.
But it was a very, very complicated situation at that
very
time,
very complicated.
Right?
Yeah. To this day, it still is.
Still is, right?
I mean, think about it.
We have Berkeley Park.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's really something.
And then,
yeah.
of course, you had the skimming of the casinos going on.
Mm-hmm.
During the 70s, they had they were fighting with the Spiro brothers, all of whom were eventually killed. And then four of them. And then, and then they, of course, had the River Key War going mm-hmm. on, and it was a literal war, in mafia.
When you have a bombing,
terms.
That's a war. Yeah.
yeah. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. And they had, I think, three of them down
wow.
there. And and then, of course, multiple people were being killed.
Right.
And Freddie Bonadonna, whose story is really interesting because he ended up testifying behind a screen in Congress. and he went into the Federal Witness Protection Program. I do have a videotape of a driving tour that Freddie made when he came back. He snuck back into Kansas City, and he drove around the, all the Italian section and talked about, because he grew up under the mafia system because his father was a mobster and who was killed by the Civella faction. His story is fascinating. Freddie Bonadonna, I believe he ended up committing suicide in 1982, 83, something like that, because he just couldn't continue on living with the life that
he had chosen.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Terrence O'Malley. It's always very, very fascinating. He wrote Nellie Don, A Stitch in Time, also made it into a musical here recently and is still being shown in theaters in the Kansas City area. Then Shooting Back in Time, Union Station Massacre, and then Black Hand Straw Man, History of Organized Crime in Kansas City, which we just talked about. And the next time we sit down with you, it'll be about Tom and Harry, the boss and the president.
Yeah.
So you've written all these. I don't know how you find time. How'd you find time for be a lawyer while you're doing all this?
Well, I tell people I have a lousy golf game.
And a very tolerant wife.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because you're and then when you're not doing that, you're playing music at Conroy's on Friday night. So I was sitting down at the piano and playing music. It's you're awesome, pal.
It's a lot of fun.
I appreciate it. Yeah.
You.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
I've been here several times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we've had a good time. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me.
Won't be the last time.
Okay.
Hey, folks. Terrence O'Malley. Another reason why there's just something about Kansas City.
Very good.